BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, welcome to this Moneybox podcast. A debt charity says councils in England and Wales risk causing significant harm to people in council tax arrears by the way they try to make them pay up. And millions of tenants do not insure their possessions. Is that a false economy? But first, the government is writing to more than 100,000 people aged 66 or more, encouraging them to claim the means-tested benefit pension credit, which of course now entitles them to the winter fuel payment of £200 or £300 as well. The letters will go out from next month to people the Department for Work and Pensions has identified as likely to be entitled, but that could still leave over 500,000 people who could claim it without it. Moneybox's Emma Smith has been looking at the details of this new plan. Emma, over the years, I've seen many government plans to increase take-up of pension credit. Why might this one be different?
Well, Paul, it was an experiment started last year under the previous government. The Department for Work and Pensions used information from local councils to find pensioners who claimed housing benefit and were likely to be entitled to pension credit, but who didn't get it. Letters were sent to these 700 households in July last year, inviting them to make a claim, followed up with a reminder in September. Of those, 195 made a successful claim and are now getting around an extra £51 per week. That's a success rate of just over a quarter. Normally, without nudging, less than 1 in 20 would be expected to apply.
You should be a more or less, Emma. The numbers in that experiment were very small, but the new government is now expanding it.
Yes, the DWP will write to 120,000 pensioners next month, inviting them to claim, again, based on housing benefit data. But this is still well short of the number who could claim it but don't. The latest figures published last week estimate that up to 760,000 are missing out.
And what's really important this year, of course, is that connection between pension credit and the winter fuel payment, which is worth £200 or £300. Only pensioners on pension credit now qualify for it.
Yes, it used to be paid to almost everyone over 66, but as part of the Chancellor's plans to plug what she calls a £22 billion black hole in the nation's finances, pensioners will need to be on pension credit to receive it. She said that this will save £1.5 billion per year. But of course, the more people who claim pension credit and get winter fuel payment, the less the Chancellor will save.
Thanks, Emma. Well, even before that campaign, record numbers of new claims have been made for pension credit, including one from Priscilla, who spoke to us this morning.
I literally cannot afford to live as I have been without the winter fuel allowance. And when that was cut, and it said that you could have it if you were on pension credit, I thought, well, I'd better try again. It's nearly a third of my income, an extra £50 a week as the pension credit, and I'm getting the winter fuel thing. I'm going to be able to survive much more happily. My fuel bills last winter were not covered by the extra, but they will be by the extra money. I have been cutting back a bit, and I won't need to do it so much.
Well, one happy listener there. The Department for Work and Pensions told us it urges anyone who thinks they may be entitled to check now. And it's deploying 500 more people to process the growing number of claims. Well, with me in the studio is Devon Gilani from Policy in Practice, which helps people navigate the benefit system. First, Devon, Priscilla got an extra £50 a week, £2,500 a year, as well as that winter fuel payment, as did many of those in the DWP experiment. Why is it so hard to get pensioners to claim those transforming amounts of money?
Yeah, I mean, it's an essential element of support because it helps pensioners like Priscilla to eat healthier, heat their home, to take a more active role in society. I think it's really important to encourage people to claim. I think the fact that it's quite complicated, I think there are three main issues. People don't know about pension credit, or if they do know about it, they immediately assume they won't be entitled. So I'd encourage people to check, firstly. The second big challenge is it can be complicated to apply. You might need to find information about any other income you've got or your savings, and people might need extra help if they don't speak English as a first language. And the third reason, and the biggest one that we see, is kind of shame and stigma. People don't feel like it's something that is for them. And I'd say one odd effect of the winter fuel payment cut is it's starting to reverse that, because we were getting winter fuel payment. Now you'll only get it, as we heard from Priscilla, if you get pension credit. And it's starting to change people's views on that.
Yes, and of course, you know, they've paid tax all their lives, so they're as entitled to that as they are to the state pension, aren't they?
Absolutely.
Now, since the Chancellor made her announcement, the number applying, as I said, has more than doubled, in fact. And one listener told us he hadn't got his money even now, despite those 500 extra staff. Now, if there is a delay, will the money be backdated to the date when they claimed?
Yeah, so any claims that are started by December the 21st means your winter fuel payment will be backdated to that date. But it's still worth checking after that date as well, because pension credit can actually be worth quite a bit more than the winter fuel payment and entitles you to other support too, like the warm home discount and other support as well.
Yes, well, as we heard from Priscilla. Now, Emma explained this latest campaign, and when they did this trial, more than a quarter of those contacted twice made a successful claim. So could the full trial have a significant effect on take-up of this benefit?
Yeah, so through Housing Benefit, we think you can identify around one in six of those who should be claiming pension credit but aren't. That's a substantial number, about 140,000 or so. So if you think about a third of those going on to claim, that's another 40, 50,000 pensioners getting the support that they need. That's on top of new figures released this week that showed, compared to the year before the winter fuel payment announcement, there's been an increase in uptake of around 110,000 more people claiming pension credit. And that's before the winter fuel payment changes.
Yes.
So that's really good news.
And the Treasury built in a rise, hadn't it? It had built that into the savings figures. But of course, if more people claim, could it ever be enough to dent the savings that the Chancellor wants to make, this £1.5 billion?
So we think so. But again, we think that's a good thing because it means pensioners getting the support that they're eligible for. So our best estimates are by Christmas, we think there'll be around 120,000 more successful claims for pension credit. And I think the Treasury had built in around 100,000. So that's 20,000 additional claims by Christmas, according to our estimates. Mm. Obviously, we'll have to wait and see what transpires, but you can still continue to claim pension credit afterwards. Mm. And what I'd say is I really hope this isn't just a one-off campaign in response to the winter fuel payment cut. I'd like to see DWP run these campaigns every year. I'd like to see them expand them like some of the best local authorities run take-up campaigns on attendance allowance, on free school meals, on healthy start support for families and children. So helping people access the support they're eligible for is a really positive thing to do.
Yes, and just very briefly, Linda has emailed this morning saying that there are two groups of pensioners. Old pensioners can actually get pension credit on a higher income than new pensioners, can't they? And she thinks that we don't mention that enough.
Yeah, it's really important to check. So it isn't just the thresholds of if your income's below £220 a week or £330 a week if you're a couple, because there's other criteria that may mean you've got exemptions, or if you've got savings, you might be eligible on slightly higher incomes. So it's definitely worth going to one of the benefit calculators on gov.uk to check. Seeing if you're eligible, not just for yourself, but for others too.
Devin Galani of Policy and Practice, thanks. Well, if you're over 66 and you feel hard up, as Priscilla did, do what she did. Try again. You can claim online, gov.uk, search pension credit claim, or by calling 0800 99 1234 in office hours. And on Wednesday, Moneybox Live with Felicity Hannah is explaining how you can check if you're missing out on benefits, social tariffs, tax-free childcare, other things, if you successfully applied for more help, or indeed, if you have a question about what you're entitled to, let her know. Email moneybox@bbc.co.uk, or send a message or voice note on WhatsApp 03306 783 183. Now, councils in England and Wales risk causing significant harm to people in arrears with their council tax by the way they try to recover those debts. That warning is from the debt charity Step Change. In a report given exclusively to Moneybox, it says many people behind with their council tax are already struggling with their finances and with other debts, and it calls for radical changes in the way council tax arrears are pursued, warning that current practices can damage the health and well-being of people in arrears. Moneywatch reporter Dan Whitworth went to Grimsby to meet 25-year-old Michael.
Michael.
Dan.
Hello, mate. How are you?
I'm good, are you?
I'm very well, sir. I'm very well.
So, Michael, talk me through where we are. We've walked into a bar.
Yeah, so this is my rock club that I co-own with about 20 others. Everything from tributes to originals.
As well as rock music, another one of Michael's passions is motorbikes. And it was a serious accident 4 years ago, one he was lucky to survive, which left him in serious financial trouble, bringing in no more than statutory sick pay.
So I was a software developer. I was on a pretty good wage. But once I had the accident, I was on £90 a week. We pretty much had to pick and choose what debts we wanted to pay each month, me and my partner at the time. So it was a case of council tax one day, pay for the bike the next, the mortgage another, maybe put a bigger food shop in this week. We were getting about just under a grand's worth of debt every month. So we were borrowing off people as well, just trying to get by.
In total, when things were at their worst, Michael owed nearly £30,000. And he says while most of his creditors either worked out manageable payment plans or cancelled his debt altogether because of what he'd been through, his council tax debt was different.
They demanded the full payment in one lump sum.
Full payment? What, you mean a whole year's worth of payment?
Yes. The full £1,000 outstanding balance.
But you didn't have that money?
I had no money. And they'd just keep demanding more and more money and sending me more and more bills until it escalated to bailiffs. I had letters near enough every month, every fortnight, saying that there'd been phone calls, saying there'd been... And I said, you're welcome to come round because there's absolutely nothing in here.
There was nothing for them to take?
Nothing, not even a carpet.
Sum up how you think your council tax debt has been dealt with compared to the other debts that you were dealing with at the time.
So it was the biggest and the scariest, obviously, because... Well, just look through this pile of paperwork. I've had so many court summons. It's unreal. The bailiffs have knocked on the door that many times and, you know, the only thing they could take is my daughter's cot. So that was terrifying. You feel useless at the time because you can't pay for anything and it's just absolutely depressing. But their behaviour is disgusting. The bailiffs are unregulated. They add charges on willy-nilly and demand stupid payments that no one can afford. It's like the Wild West. It's absolutely unruly.
Well, that was Michael talking to Dan Whitworth. With me in the studio is Peter Tutton, head of policy at the debt charity Step Change. Peter Tutton, you're warning about how councils collect these debts, but there is £6 billion of arrears. It is rising. Why can't they just be allowed to collect it in the most effective way?
So the way that £6 billion has got to, what we've seen is reductions in things like council tax support, council tax going up, but the cost of living crisis as well. So that money that's being owed is being owed by people who have no ability to repay it. What we see with people coming to us is they're very often on low incomes, often have things like health problems as well. They're facing, like Michael, unaffordable payment demands that then can be escalated to aggressive collection practices quite quickly. The more aggressive you get doesn't mean you're going to get the money that isn't there.
So you're saying it's an inefficient way. There are better ways. And indeed, Michael did say that some of the people he owes money, some of the organisations he owes money to, I think one of them even let him off his debt. It forgave his debt. Others have introduced payment plans. Do councils not do that?
So councils can do that. There is some really good practice from local authorities out there. But it's a bit of a lottery. There's nothing that is compelling consistency across the local authorities to behave in what we would consider to be good practice, what we see as good practice in other areas like financial services and utilities, where regulators have, as a result of cost of living crisis, have raised expectations on the way that firms should treat people.
And is that kind of life that obviously Michael and his partner lived for a while, of what has he put it, picking and choosing which bills to pay? I mean, that's no way to live, really, is it?
No, it isn't. But that is the consequence of where you have poor collections practice. We see this. This is one of the things that makes debt problems worse. So we see people trying to keep up with the council tax by not paying their utility bills, their energy, or rationing their energy, or not paying their rent or their mortgage, or borrowing. That makes debt problems worse and worse, and it builds up health problems, poor well-being, say problems with work, problems with relationships.
And what about bailiffs? Michael complained a lot about the way bailiffs behaved, and we talk about that. I mean, obviously, there are good bailiffs. And the local government association told us its members have a duty to collect tax, obviously, and bailiffs are only used as a last resort. Is that your experience?
No, I don't think that's true at all. So there's something like over a million cases passed to bailiffs in the past
in
year.
Council tax debt,
research from Centre for Social Justice. So actually some councils are sending stuff to bailiffs really quickly because it's free for them to send it to bailiffs. It pushes all the cost on people in difficulty. And as Michael said, you know, there's not the standards of practice there, very intrusive, makes problems worse.
Yeah, there's no statutory body overseeing them. Councils, though, are under such huge financial pressure, aren't they? What changes do you want to see that will balance the money they have to collect and the practice of how they collect it that you've been critical of?
So the first thing to say there is actually, you know, cost of living crisis, we've seen energy debt go up and we've seen council tax debt go up. But council tax recovery rate is still about 96%. Chasing after people who are very financially vulnerable is not going to solve the problem with local government or any public service funding. It's not the way to go forward. What we need instead is actually good, if you have good practice, if you think that what are people doing to respond to aggressive collections practice and enforcement by bailiffs, by borrowing elsewhere, by not paying other bills, that creates more harm, and that more harm leads to problems like, you know, threats of homelessness, poor health. These all put more costs onto public services. So it's a false economy to think that going hard after people who can't pay is the solution to local authorities' financing.
And very briefly, do you think the government should be helping people more with their council tax bills?
So yes, the council tax support scheme isn't working properly. And what we really want the government to do is reform the way that council tax collection rules work to make it fairer, like we see in other sectors.
Peter Tutton of Step Change, thanks. Well, Dan is back from Grimsby, of course, now. What reaction to this report, Dan, from Michael's local council?
Well, North East Lincolnshire Council told us it can't comment on individual cases, but it would encourage anyone who thinks they may be getting into debt to contact them so they can let them know about various support schemes and that they offer payment plans. The Westminster government told me its published guidance makes clear it expects local authorities to be proportionate and sympathetic to those in hardship.
Thanks, Dan. Now, nearly half of the people who rent their home have no insurance for their possessions. New data given exclusively to Moneybox by the comparison site Money Supermarket found that 45% of tenants are completely uninsured for their possessions, leaving them at risk, it says, of an average £6,000 bill to replace their belongings if they're struck by fire, flood or theft. Of course, it's not just money you lose after a disaster like that. Struggling to replace clothes, phones, computers and other possessions just adds to the emotional stress of losing precious memories in many cases as well. As Moneybox listener Dan explained to us.
After the fire ripped through it, we weren't able to sort of legally live there because it was completely destroyed. We were able to go back and sort of try and retrieve what we could. It was pretty much gone. Like, you couldn't have lived there. You couldn't have stayed there for more than about 20 minutes because the sort of stench of it and the ash and everything was awful. Everything we had in the kitchen, there was nothing salvageable. Aside from that, it was a huge amount of clothes. I have a sort of quite, well, I had a relatively big record collection and all of those have been damaged to the point where I can't use them. They're unusable now. Myself and my partner are both musicians, so there were musical instruments that are now unusable. One of the people had taken out contents insurance for their things and, you know, they'd received something like in between £5,000 and £10,000 as sort of compensation for all of the things that they lost in the fire. We've got to a point now where we've kind of recouped what we've lost, but it's taken a very long time and it's put us on the back foot for like the past 5 years or so. So we've had to kind of start again a little bit.
Well, with me in the studio listening to that sad story is Dr. Matthew Connell, who is Director of Policy and Public Affairs at the Chartered Insurance Institute. Matthew Connell, why do so many tenants not have contents insurance?
Yes, and listening to that piece, it really does bring home how sad and how what an impact not having insurance can be. I think some of the big reasons are people who are renters maybe don't know how long they're going to be living in a house. They don't want to take out a contract for a whole year for insurance. Obviously, budgets are tight, so they don't want to be spending hundreds of pounds on contents insurance. And it's just really making the whole thing relevant to them and their circumstances. Whereas perhaps in the past, everything's been geared more towards people with mortgages.
Yes, and if you have a mortgage, of course, you have to insure the building. So does that lead you to insure the contents? You're sold that at the same time very often.
Yeah, that's a sort of natural step. And again, for renters, they make sure their landlord's all right because they pay them a deposit. But then it's up to individuals to decide. And sometimes the most valuable object might be an electric bike or the goods people need for their work. It's not always that obvious. So it really is important for insurers to to find solutions. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yes. I mean, the cost can be modest, can't it? I mean, Money Helper says it can be £132, £11 a month. I've heard other people say £12, £15 a month. Yeah. But Vivian has tweeted just now and saying, if you're trying to pay £2,000 a month rent, which isn't that uncommon, out of a modest salary, you will cut back on things like insurance. Is that just the reality of where we are?
It is, yes. And so, for example, for people in social housing, what insurers have done is teamed up with councils and housing associations. And the councils and housing associations have taken on some of the administration and the cost so that insurance can be provided, meaningful insurance can be provided for less than £5, £5 a month. So there are ways through it, but it has to be done in an imaginative way.
Yes, and of course, landlords, do they have any responsibility for this? I mean, private landlords compared with those public ones.
No statutory responsibility. And I guess, you know, there's some comments. The Institute of Public Policy Research, a think tank, for example, said maybe the money that's given in deposits to landlords, maybe that should take a form of insurance to help both the landlord and the tenant a bit more.
Yes, I can't see that being terribly popular, but it could be a solution. And of course, in a way, I suppose, today we're encouraging people in private rented accommodation to certainly think about taking out insurance if they're in this 45% who don't have it. When you're choosing it, what's the key thing you should check? Because cheap isn't necessarily best, is it, by any means?
Yeah, I think the first thing is maybe just go round your house, every room, and photograph the most valuable items, because that's a big thing, having evidence that you've got those possessions, and then really think about the best insurance, because, you know, traditional home insurance might only insure each object up to, say, £1,000, and you might have an electric bike that's worth £2,000. So it really is a case of looking at what's the most valuable thing in where you live, and then thinking what's the best insurance for it.
Yes, and I suppose insuring things like jewellery and expensive items of clothing as well, because they can be a lot more than average, can't they? So don't look for the cheapest. What about things like, just briefly, things like accidental damage? Because it's not just major crises that cause claims, is it?
Yes, and people don't always realise they might be liable to their landlord. For example, carpets. You'd think that was part of the building's insurance, but if they're not glued down, then tenants might be liable for damage to carpets if they've damaged them accidentally, had a big party and ruined all the carpets, they've got to pay the costs.
Yes, the cost of a big party in private rented accommodation. Matthew Connell of the CII, thanks very much. And just finally, a reminder that this week, new rules came in to protect people who are tricked into sending money from their bank account to thieves. After our special programme on that change last Saturday, we were delighted to get this voice note from Kate.
Having listened to your programme last week about the increased sophistication of scammers, I was called today by somebody who told me that they were from my bank, that somebody had fraudulently applied for a credit card in my name. He texted me a code. He told me that the call was going to be recorded. And it was your piece that really alerted me to the fact that that wasn't actually reassuring. And he became very impatient and quite aggressive when I wouldn't do what he said. And it was obviously then that I realised that it was a scam. So I'd like to thank you for that warning and thought I had to let you know.
Thank you, Kate. Our pleasure. And my rules, of course, never engage, put the phone down. Then you can't be robbed. Well, you can beat the thieves, but you can't beat the clock. And we have come to the end of our podcast time. But you can rewind it, of course, to listen again. If you don't subscribe, now's the time to do it on BBC Sounds, so you never miss a fun-packed episode just after it's broadcast live on Saturday at midday on BBC Radio 4. If you want us to know about your money worries or joys, email moneybox@bbc.co.uk. Or now you can send a comment or a voice note, like Kate did, on WhatsApp 03306 783 183. That's 03306 783 183. We do read them all, and you might get on the podcast, you never know. In this podcast, the reporters were Dan Whitworth and Emma Smith, researcher Joe Krasner, studio manager Wayne Parks. The editor was Sarah Rogers. I'm Paul Lewis, and this was the BBC News Money and Work production for BBC Sounds. And now,
Hello, I'm Amol Rajan.
And I'm Nick Robinson, and from BBC Radio 4, this is the Today Podcast.
And Nick, this is the moment to ask you what you most enjoy about spending a couple of hours in my company each week.
Well, that would be enough in itself, but the fun is to go in depth on a story with an expert guest and for you and I to try and really get what's going on.
I have CCTV on my home. I've had people rip my gates down.
Is it worth it, Andrew? Being an MP,
on no occasion
did they know.
Did the scan that I'd had ever appear in the other hospital. So what do you enjoy most about doing?
I love the fact that we've got a really strong sense of community. And yes, I love some of our star guests too. Frank Skinner! Yay!
This is where we need tinned applause.
I'm going to clap as well, just to thicken it up.
Listen and subscribe on BBC Sounds.